welcome to the new series of The Book Show. We're delighted to return for another series and look forward to bringing you lots of interviews and discussions. Over the coming season, we'll be chatting to Irish and international writers, exploring the works of well-known authors, and introducing you to many new names. Coming up tonight, we speak to Sarah Baum and find out about Carson McCullough's trips to Ireland to meet with Elizabeth Bowen and John Huston. But first, The Psychopath Test is a best-selling book by John Ronson, which is currently in development as a film starring Scarlett Johansson. The book is subtitled A Journey Through the Madness Industry, and in it, Ronson meets psychopaths, psychiatrists, and reports on the media coverage of mental health. John and guests will appear at Vicar Street in Dublin on March 23rd, and John joins me now from New York to tell us a bit more about both book and show. This book, which has been out for a while, so I'm sure some people have read it, but you know, other people won't have, but it opens with something of a mystery in that this book is being sent to various academics who work in certain fields, and it sort of sounds like one thing led to the next. So tell me a little bit about how it started.
The real starting point was a psychologist called Martha Stout, who said to me that basically psychopaths rule the world. You're significantly more likely to have a psychopath at the top of the tree than at the bottom, because capitalism rewards psychopathic character traits. The lack of empathy, the lack of remorse, the grandiose sense of self-worth, the superficial charm. These are things that are all rewarded by the system that we've created for ourselves. And when she said that to me, I thought that's one of the biggest thoughts that anybody has ever said to me, that there's a particular brain anomaly or mental disorder, whatever you want to call it, that's so powerful it controls society. And of all the brain anomalies it could have been, it had to be psychopaths. And then I had a brainwave. I remember it so clearly. I was cycling through Primrose Hill, pondering this, and I suddenly thought, what if I learn how to be a psychopath spotter, and then I can journey into the corridors of power to see if I can spot any psychopaths? And then I thought, you know what? Whatever happens will be interesting.
You do say in the book as well, though, that, you know, that, and they do say this generally, that, you know, people who work in as CEOs and positions of power and world leaders are more likely to be psychopathic. So do you think that people like Theresa May, and probably more so Donald Trump, are anywhere on the psychopath scale?
Well, OK, so here is the problem with that. It's kind of one of the conclusions I come to in the psychopath test is that it's kind of psychopathic to define people as psychopaths from afar. It involves a kind of grandiose sense of self-worth and a lack of empathy. So in a way, you know, even if I think that Donald Trump has, you know, higher levels of narcissism than one would like to see in another human being, as tempting as it is, I think it's wrong to start bandying around mental health diagnoses, particularly from afar. Somebody on Twitter, a mental health advocate, said a really interesting thing to me about this the other day, which was basically like, you know, first they come, like in times of crisis, we lurch towards negative stereotypes. You know, let's not do that with Donald Trump and mental health diagnoses, because, you know, you start bandying around terms like psychopath with Donald Trump and everyone's like fine with it. But then who's next? Like who are we going to call a psychopath next? And eventually it's you.
Sure.
Not you. Actually, you.
No. Actually me. But it's funny, you do mention in the book, you mentioned that famous psychiatry handbook, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And Alan Francis, who wrote that, did write to the New York Times recently to say Trump does not have narcissistic personality disorder. He's a lot of things, but it's actually shameful to people who suffer with mental health to call him those things. So he was agreeing with you, I think.
He was. I've talked to Alan Francis a couple of times, and he said one of the reasons why Donald Trump shouldn't be labelled a sufferer of narcissistic personality disorder is one of the criteria is that it has to impair them and debilitate them. I can't remember the exact words, but it's basically, you know, it has to negatively impact the quality of their life. Part of the criteria for a diagnosis of a mental disorder is distress and impairment, and Donald Trump doesn't have those. And that leads me to ask two questions. One, how does he know that Donald Trump isn't distressed or impaired? you know, he's not close to Donald Trump. We don't see him when he's alone in his room. But secondly, psychopathy is a pleasant feeling mental disorder. There's no anxiety, there's no guilt, there's no remorse. So there's a disorder that doesn't involve distress to the sufferer as opposed to the victim.
As you always do in your work, you interviewed an awful lot of people and you travelled and went to a lot of places. And for the book, I mean, there's stories about mental facilities and experiments and child killers and rapists and all sorts of things. Was there any particular case or story that kept you awake at night when you were working on that book?
On the psychopath? I had some personal fear that I would be killed by psychopaths. People were warning me, like, they're dangerous. Psychopaths are dangerous. They don't have any empathy or conscience. So it means that they could harm you and not feel in the least bit bad about it. So I did have some concern just in general about, like, not giving up my address to people, not giving up my phone number to people. I met some chilling people when I was writing that book. I met a Haitian death squad leader in prison in upstate New York who kept saying to me, I just want people to like me. He said, I just want people to like me. And then I said to him, finally, isn't that a weakness to really want people to like you? And he said, no, 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 it's not a weakness. And I'll tell you why. If you can get people to like you, you can manipulate them to do whatever you want them to do. So I said, so you're the sort of person who doesn't feel empathy. And he went, no. So I was meeting, like, damaged people, and I had to be careful. Saying that, I felt more scared when I was writing So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which was my book about Twitter outrage.
In terms of that topic, it's very ongoing. So you took high-profile cases, a lot of people who had been, well, witch-hunted in a lot of ways, and you remain quite objective about why that topic and why a book?
I think part of the reason was what I was just heading towards, which was the realisation that en masse on Twitter, nice people like us, and I'm not really talking about, like, horrendous trolls. I'm not really talking about people like that. I'm talking about nice people like us thinking that we're doing something good are more frightening than psychopaths. Like, I was more frightened at the idea of those people turning on me than I was at the idea of a psychopath tracking me down. And as it turned out, those people, as a result of my book coming out, did go for me, and it was just horrendous. It was deeply upsetting. We had become the crazy people that I always wrote about. We were the ones abusing our power. And that felt like a big shift. It felt worrying, like a kind of aggressive authoritarianism was taking over, and it would lead to chaos. And I needed to write about it for kind of moral reasons, I think.
Before you go, what are you working on next?
I've started writing a new book. I'm quite early into it, but I feel, you know, when I wrote my first book, Them, was all about conspiracy theorists and white separatists on the fringes of society. And those people are no longer on the fringe. They now have, literally, the people I wrote about in Them now have the ear of a president. So I'm going to write a new book about these people that I knew 20 years ago. They're now in power. They're now writing the culture. But it's going to be like an adventure story.
And it sounds very, very timely. All of John Ronson's books are published by Picador. And if you'd like to go along to see the psychopath test with John and guests, it'll be at Vicar Street in Dublin on March 23rd. And you can find out more information on vicarstreet.com. Thank you so much, John.
Thanks, Sinead.
Now, writer Carson McCullers was born 100 years ago, and she wrote only a handful of novels, plays and short stories, but is still considered one of America's most important writers. She wrote in great detail about life in the American South in novels such as The Member of the Wedding and The Ballad of the Sad Café. She came to Ireland 3 times, and Zoe Cummins has been finding out about these trips, including her last one, just months before she died.
Lulu Carson Smith, better known now as Carson McCullers, was born 100 years ago, in February 1917, in the small Georgia city of Columbus.
It was a mill town, and she was sort of solidly middle class. Her father owned a jewelry store, and her mother was a housewife.
Carlos Jews is an expert on her life and work.
I often say that I know more about her life than I know about my own. She was greatly influenced by the town she grew up in because it was typical of sort of the rural South at the time. It was racially segregated with a very rigid class structure. She was very much influenced by her experience of the Jim Crow or racially segregated South. And the religious conservatism and the conservatism in general of the place both influenced her desire to escape from there as soon as possible and also informed the sensitivity that she displays in a lot of her work.
I yearned for one particular thing, to get away from Columbus and to make my mark in the world. At first, I wanted to be a concert pianist, and Mrs. Tucker encouraged me in this.
Jenna Logan reads from Carson McCullers' autobiography.
Mrs. Tucker was to me the embodiment of Bach, Mozart, and all beautiful music, which at age 13 had enveloped all my soul.
Unfortunately, a childhood case of rheumatic fever that was not properly diagnosed and treated meant that she had enough cardiovascular damage that she simply didn't have the physical stamina to continue. When she was bedridden, having to reconcile herself to her physical disabilities began at such an early age.
The sinister illness that haunted my life all during my youth till the time I was 29 had asserted itself. I lived in a constant fear of strokes.
It also, in some ways, gave her an excuse to not have to participate in things that would have distracted her from her sort of artistic intentions. So it was a blessing and a curse. She had her first stroke when she was in her early 20s and had periodic strokes for the rest of her life until she had a massive final stroke at age 50 in 1967.
Her novels, like The Heart is a Lonely Hunter and The Member of the Wedding, show a sensitivity which is perhaps born out of her own physical restrictions and her emotional state.
And they were primarily about the struggles of adolescent characters struggling to fit in a world that they didn't feel comfortable in, or struggling to find a way out of the situation, often a way to escape from where they were born and where they were living. So she would have young musicians who were struggling with their talent, trying to develop their talent to the level that they could use it as a springboard to escape from where they were from, or young people dealing with trying to find other people like themselves. She was very much concerned with adolescence throughout her writing life, and that was evident from the very beginning in the first things that she wrote.
As McCullers' career progresses, she connects with writers in Ireland and the UK. She made three visits to Ireland in the 50s and 60s. Her first were to Cork and to writer Elizabeth Bowen in Bowen's Court, although McCullers' expectations of Bowen's circumstance were a little different to what she found.
I think this may be a common misperception by many Americans, Carson included, that people who live in a place that might even have their name attached to it, that you automatically think of sort of like Downton Abbey or something. She was quite shocked that the facilities at Bowen Court, that it was not this grand estate. There was even concerns about, you know, basic amenities, running water and electricity and indoor toilets and things, that she didn't expect it to be as sort of rustic as it turned out to be.
Elizabeth Bowen is a dear friend of mine. I've admired her work for many years, and when we met in New York, she asked me to visit her in Ireland. Bowen Court, her estate there, is not a beautiful house, but it is roomy and charming.
McCullers' last visit to Ireland was to John Huston in St. Clarence in Galway.
Her visit to Ireland during 1967, which was also the year of her death, may have been one of the most poignant experiences of her life.
Huston had just directed an adaptation of her novel, Reflections in a Golden Eye.
Brando.
You disgust me.
Elizabeth Taylor.
Have you ever been collared and dragged out into the street and thrashed by a naked woman?
I swear I'll do it!
They cast Marlon Brando and Elizabeth Taylor and Brian Keith and Julie Harris for the four major roles in the picture, which was quite a star-studded cast at the time.
When John Huston invited me to go to Ireland this year, I joyfully accepted, and the visit was one of the happiest times of my life. John was the first person I told about the leg operation in respect to the amputation. He said, "It will be a blessing to be rid of all that useless pain."
They developed this friendship during the process of making the film. I mean, it just in the last few years of her life, I think he knew that year of 1967 might be her last because her health was really failing. But her health was so bad and she was paralyzed and her body was in such a state that she couldn't, you know, travel on a normal airline seat. And so he arranged for seats to be taken out of a plane so that a stretcher could be accommodated so that she could fly over. And she flew over with her long-term housekeeper, Ida Reeder, and were there, I think, a few weeks. And he really treated her like royalty.
There was a constant stream of visitors, and John is a grand senor. Since my leg was jutting out, I had to stay in bed all the time. But visitors came constantly to my room. In the evening, everyone would come in to have brandy and coffee with me. There was talk of fox hunting, of art, of politics, and of course, reflections in a golden eye.
The Irish Times did an article about her visit there at the time, and there's a wonderful photograph of John Huston sitting next to her bed, speaking with her, and there's a large crucifix above her head on the wall at the head of the bed. There's another photograph of the two of them hugging, where he's leaning over into the bed and hugging her with their faces pressed together. It's a very moving photograph. And she died, I think, less than 60 days after she returned from that trip. And in some ways, it was the sort of final punctuation of her having found both artistic acceptance, but also having connected with a group of like-minded artists that she was always looking for so near the end of her life.
Well, if you'd like to read more of Carson McCullough's work, you could start with her early novel, The Member of the Wedding, and work from there. All readings in that piece were taken from Carlos Dew's Carson McCullough's Stories, Plays and Other Writings, which is published by the Library of America. And we put all of Carlos Dew's titles on the RTE Bookshow website, as they include many of Carson McCullough's writings. Finally this evening, Sarah Baum's debut novel, Spill, Simmer, Falter, Wither, gathered much praise and many prizes for the Cork-based writer. And her second novel has just been published. A Line Made by Walking tells the story of Frankie, an artist in her mid-20s who escapes city life to live in her dead grandmother's house. It's a story of art, of a young woman who's struggling to become an artist, and a love letter to the Irish countryside. Sarah joins me in studio. So Sarah, Frankie decides to pack up her life and to take herself off to her grandmother's house. So where is that house and what are her reasons for going there?
The house is in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it's no place in particular, though I did stay in my grandmother's house. It's not sort of the countryside around it has sort of morphed. And there is a wind turbine, which is plays a sort of significant part. It's something that's happening now. People, they're kind of popping up, just solitary ones, quite close to people's houses. Another important landmark, I think, is there's a daffodil farm on the opposite side of the valley. And this was, I was living somewhere else, nothing to do with my grandmother's house or where I grew up, but there happened to be daffodil farms. And there was something so gorgeous about seeing this green field, and then it gets yellower and yellower and yellower. And then gradually there's an incident in the book where the daffodils are picked. And I just thought, God, that would make such a interesting experience to live under.
So why is she there? Is she running away? Is she hiding? Or is she doing something else altogether?
A bit of both, in fact. She's lost and was living in Dublin in a bedsit, and just was crushed by life and working part-time in an art gallery, or was she sort of not working, I think, at the point the book took place, and was crushed by high rents and by urban life, and escapes in a way, initially sort of just has a breakdown and calls her mother, and her mother comes and picks her up and she stays with her parents for a week. And then she remembers about her grandmother's house, which is just, you know, it's sort of recession Ireland and it's just sitting on the market. And so she convinces her mother to let her go and stay there, you know, to caretake it, to look after it, but really just because she wants to get away and hide from everything.
Throughout the novel, the character of Frankie, she's testing herself about great works of art. What's she trying to prove to herself by doing that?
She's trying to continue to learn things in the aftermath. I think there's a paragraph somewhere that kind of says, you know, now that I'm no longer learning, now that she's no longer a student or either in school or college or anywhere, you know, and I've just found that such an interesting experience about growing up, that, you know, we're supposed to learn more and keep learning, whereas in fact we sort of reach a stage where we stop learning and just do. And so she's distressed about that. She doesn't want to forget. So she keeps trying to remind herself of works that she's encountered in college or learned about in college. But it's also in an attempt to find meaning in the same way that, you know, we listen to songs that make us feel something, that either make us feel sad or fill us up with sort of joy. Or I do it even coming up on the train. I was like, there's certain songs that I play to get me geared up for doing like events and talking to people.
What songs?
The best one one is Flaming Lips, the Yoshimi, the robot.
Battles the,
it's something, Battles yeah, the Killer yeah. Robot, something like yeah. that. Yeah, it's a ridiculous song, but it's confidence building.
Well, there's a lot of art in the book, and one of the pieces of work that Frankie talks about is a piece by Eve Klein. Let's hear you read a section from the book about this piece of art.
Works about flight. I test myself. Eve Klein, 1960. A black and white photograph which shows the artist lying in the air several feet above a Parisian street. Deserted, save for the flying man and a bicyclist in the distance. At the time, people couldn't figure out how Klein had made the image without being seriously injured. Now, in this era when any illusion is possible, tedious even, nobody cares about the photograph anymore, which was, of course, a photo montage, and the artist was, in fact, hurt, despite being trained in judo and landing on a tightly drawn sheet. Leap into the void, it was called. And so maybe it wasn't a work about flying after all, but a work about falling. About how flying and falling are almost exactly the same.
And that was Sarah Baum reading there from A Line Made by Walking. The book's title comes from an actual piece of art by Richard Long from 1967. He's a Bristol-based artist. What is this artwork? Tell me about it.
A Line Made by Walking is kind of his first and most significant artwork. Richard Long is still alive and still very much making work. And what's fascinating is that like he's continued to make work in the same vein about walking. He was still a student in St. Martin's College of Art in London, and he took a train outside London towards Bristol and the countryside and found a field and walked up and down and up and down, got off the train, obviously walked up and down and up and down till he'd made a visible track through the grass, a straight line, and then took a photograph of it. And to me, it really chimed with the novel because it's kind of about pointlessness. It's about repetition, about searching.
And that visual line, you know, creating that line in the grass, that going back and forward, does that sort of have something to say about futility and our actions, our own actions, and the impact that they have?
Yeah, that's what I liked about it. It wasn't originally the title, and then I couldn't think of my own title, so I'm like, I'm just going to choose one of the artworks. And in the end, that one just seemed the one that most summed up what the novel was about in a way. His work is also kind of about, you know, our relationship to the land and the tracks and trails that we leave behind in life. And he always attempts to leave as little trace as possible, you know. So he's just arranging stones or walking. And, you know, it's the tiniest things that he makes art out of. So it's kind of about leaving no trace as well as leaving it some form of trace, you know.
As I mentioned in the introduction, there's a lot of wilderness writing and nature writing in the book, but you do something really interesting with the structure in terms of nature and animals. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, the novel is structured around, there's 10 chapters and each chapter is an animal. The title page of each chapter, the photograph, is of a dead animal. And at the very beginning of the novel, Frankie finds a robin just lying in the ditch, and she's not really making artwork. And it's kind of her way, I suppose, of exercising aesthetic sensibility without really trying to make art out of it. And so she takes a photograph of the robin, and then in each chapter there is an animal discovered at some point, and she takes a photograph, and then the photographs are included as part of it. So it's macabre, but it's kind of about how we only get to see the natural world closely and appreciate it when it's already dead, which is a message for something bigger in a way as well.
Yeah, and I wondered if, you know, the animals, the fact that they're dead is some way reflective of the fact that it's clear from early on in the book that she isn't very well, but she's very detailed in her actions. So there's a sense that, is this a symptom of her illness, that she's acutely aware of movements, of observation, and do the sort of, you know, the rhythms and repetitions and ongoing testing of herself? Is that sort of to create a comfort zone almost for her?
You know, it's the slowing down and looking at things more closely. It's a great way to kind of anchor your mind when everything else seems too huge and baffling and overwhelming. I do think it's curious as well, she notices the animals. So within the space of a summer, she has noticed all of these things that, you know, mostly it would take, and I mean, in reality, it took me years to collect the photos. But I think when you're living that closely, it's like we always say, we used to live right by this cliff walk, and we go out the cliff walk literally every day, and we'd be like, there's loads of whales and dolphins out here. And the thing was, there wasn't loads of whales and dolphins. It was just the fact that we were walking it so often that every time there was a whale or dolphin, we'd see it, you know. And I think it's a bit the same with Frankie. Suddenly she starts looking for things. So kind of by creating the comfort zone, she eventually manages to pull some meaning out of it, that it becomes healing for her.
I remember you said to me when I interviewed you for the first book that you said you'd like to write two novels and then go back to being an artist. Now, obviously you didn't know it was going to happen with all the success and acclaim. So have you changed your mind about that?
No.
So two novels and that's it, you're gone.
Well, no, I don't. There's there's been writers in the past and they've kind of said, I'm going off to, and then they've come back a couple of years later. So I don't think, no. I mean, I think the next project will be sculptural. At the moment, I don't have a third book, and so I'm not writing a third book, or it would be insincere, you know.
Mm. Well, best of luck with whatever you're doing, Sarah. Thanks for joining us. A Line Made by Walking by Sarah Baum is published by Tramp Press. Well, thanks to Sarah and all our guests this evening. That's all we've time for. But you can find us on Twitter at BookshowRTE. Thanks to my producer, Regan Hutchins, and to series producer, Zoe Cummins.